Welcome, everyone. An intervention is one of the most powerful tools available for people who want to help a loved one get on that road to recovery. However, many interventions are not successful, which can have a devastating effect on everyone involved. My guest today, Dr. Louise Stenger, has been named one of the top 10 interventionists in the country by Quit Alcohol. Dr. Stenger and her teammates have performed thousands of family interventions throughout the United States and abroad. Today, she's joining me to discuss how to properly initiate an intervention, how to ensure long-term sobriety for any addiction, including alcohol, drugs, sex, gambling, or shopping. She'll also talk to us about how to parent your child to recovery from addiction, how people can begin their roads to recovery, renewal, and transformation, and all the challenges in training others to perform interventions. Dr. Louise Stenger, so grateful to have you on with me today.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here today, Erica. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's my honor and pleasure, and you have so much interesting, information to give and tips and tools, and you've been in this industry for so long, that I'm always just in awe of all the wonderful things people do to help others, and you really have gone above and beyond with that. So, this is fantastic. I know there's so many families that contact me, throughout the years, and they really don't know how to address a loved one. How can we begin this discussion today and helping people initiate that conversation?
Well, first of all, when people call me or they call you, I just want to acknowledge the courage they have in reaching out, because their hearts are hurting. People don't pick up a phone to call someone who's an interventionist unless they have experienced sort of the devastational behavior that occurs when someone is in the midst of a substance abuse or mental health disorder. And as family members, you usually hear them, they have cajoled, they have begged, they have pleaded, they have set a boundary, they have yelled, they have screamed, they have nagged, they have pleaded, they have lectured.
Right.
To no avail. And the person who is their loved one that's currently experiencing, and you'll notice I'll say substance abuse disorder or mental health disorder. It's not up to me to call anyone an alcoholic addict, because people are so much more than the sum of their parts.
I love that, yeah.
And so, so people call you, they call me, and they just don't know how to move this person to change.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's the issue, is if someone doesn't want to help themselves, it is very hard to get them help. But I do acknowledge, and I have seen people come around because of the love of their family, because maybe they can't do it for themselves in that moment, but they for some reason can do it because they see the pain in someone else's face. Do you believe that that's true?
I do. And believe me, interventions are really, in the simplest form, I call them invitations to change.
Yeah.
And every day people are invited to change. Sometimes they have external motivators, like they wrapped their car around the tree, they had a DUI, they ended up in an ER hospital, and sometimes they're internal. But when you're doing an intervention, what you're putting people together for, and you're inviting someone to get help, you're doing two things. One, you're having people speak from their hearts, and you're having them, when I coach people, after getting to know, first of all, when someone calls me up, I need to get to know everything about their loved one, and I get to know a little bit about them as well. I'll interview myself and my teammate will interview people individually, because we've learned that you learn much more about what I'll call the identified loved one or the person you want to intervene on if I talk to everyone individually first prior to putting everybody together in a group. And the questions and how we address it, and the other thing we'll do is we'll do something called a family map, which is really take a look at the history, the intergenerational history of that family. And 9 times out of 10, we're going to learn that this is a really resilient, courageous family that has experienced in its history some sort of sudden death, some type of ism, whether it be work, sex, gambling, debting, alcoholism, mental health disorder. There might be divorce. There might be some extreme religiosity. But that the person that they are intervening on, 9 times out of 10, they are not the first person in the family to have had an issue.
Right, right. Okay. So you have to understand the dynamic, yeah.
You have to understand the dynamics intergenerationally. And that becomes a big... The other thing you do is, like, just like you and I, if you had called me up and we started talking, I'd want to know a little bit about you, and I'd want to know a little bit about your relationship to your loved one. And then I would ask you, what was so special? Erica, what's so special about Johnny? What can you remember? Because when people call you up, they're angry, they're upset, they're confused, and they're bewildered, and they're sad. And we need to know something that was special. Sometimes a mom will tell me how they cared, how hard the pregnancy was, or how they rocked them, or the first time they went off to school, or a loved one, a husband might talk about a wife might talk about a husband, a sister will talk about a sister. But we want to learn what's special. And then we want to learn, why is your heart hurting? What have you experienced in the last 6 months or year? What is it that you've seen? And because when we learn those experiences and when they're conveyed in a loving, non-judgmental way, they'll help break down that honeycomb of denial that you speak about.
Right.
And then the other thing we do on... any good interventionist will do, is we're going to work with the family, and in a perfect world, what would be the best treatment solutions? Like, I'm blessed in the respect that I'm totally independent. I'm not related to any treatment center in the country. I have no fiduciary relationship. And I'm also lucky because, having been a professor and a clinician and a trainer, I've visited numerous treatment centers across the country. And not all treatment centers are alike. That's a totally different conversation, Erica. And you don't know from a website what you're getting. And so in a perfect world, if we're engaged with a family, we're also going to work with one person over what might be, given your resources, financially, emotionally, and also given what the presenting issues are with your loved one, from a biopsychosocial perspective, what might be the 3 best treatment centers in the country?
And for connect them, individually. With
them individually, so you can make that choice, because it always has to be that. And so, you know, you have a solution in mind for when you meet. And just like planning any event, you pick a date and a time, and in the kind of work I do, I give invitations. You know, and I tell people from the moment that we're engaged, you know what, you can tell your loved one, hey, Johnny, you know what, these problems have gotten bigger for our family than all of us, and I've started to see Dr. Louise and her teammate, and we're going to find solutions together.
That's so fantastic.
I really believe that you have to honor that person, because that person is truly wounded. They're operating in a shame-based fashion. And I truthfully have never met anyone in my life that said, hey, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I want to have substance abuse problems. I want to be alcoholic. I want to be addict.
Right. Of course. Of course not. Yeah. And the shame and the hopelessness that these people are experiencing, I feel like it's, you know, it's so overwhelming that if you get that family member to really keep in mind or be mindful of what is special, I feel like they could address them with a different kind of empathy and compassion. That, like, when people ask me, how do I talk to my loved one? What should I say? When you know, should I blame them? Should I talk about past things? And I'm always, I think the first thing I say is, how can we have this conversation? How can we communicate in an empathetic and compassionate way? You know, I just think that's so much more effective. And I think anybody, even hijacked by drugs and alcohol in that moment, their mind is even a teeny bit open if you come to them with some empathy. Don't you agree?
And I agree with you. And there's about 2 ways. I mean, that would take a whole big class to to do. But mm-hmm. I think when we talk to people that are wounded, we use non-judgmental terms. So,
yes.
For example, I worked on a college campus for many years, and parents would come and they would say, well, what happened, you know, over the weekend? And mm-hmm. so last weekend, Wayne, when I felt baffled, confused, disappointed,
mm-hmm.
Just amazed that Dad and I got a phone call from the police, and I felt so scared
mm-hmm.
to learn that you had been in a car accident
mm-hmm.
and that your blood level was point this.
Right.
You know, that's non-judgmental, I felt. And most
right.
people don't know that there are so many feelings, because
mm-hmm.
in the midst of this, they know angry, sad, mad.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the ways. The other way that if you're going to talk with someone who is in the midst of a disorder, it's really, we also teach how to set healthy boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So
and
important.
And really, so, and there's 5 magic words I always give people. They're
oh,
complete
good.
Sentences.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sure our audience would appreciate it. Yeah.
Yes. And so these are 5 magic words. And no, I'm not going to give you any more money. Yes. That's correct. I love you and I care about you and I'm not going to do this anymore. Oh? That's a whole sentence. Really? And sometimes people don't like this one. Whatever. Those complete sentences will, if used appropriately, will allow to put the responsibility back on the other person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really important, because in the midst of a substance abuse disorder, sometimes we inadvertently bail people out. And
right.
so part of our job to work as we help invite people to change is to allow them to develop healthy boundaries with their loved ones. In the
okay.
book I wrote, I have a chapter that says nothing changes till something changes.
Mm-hmm.
And 97% of the work that anybody does helping get a loved one to treatment and afterwards is always done with other loved ones as well. Because
right.
the person who's in the midst of the disease is going to keep doing what they're doing. And if the people around them don't change,
mm-hmm.
we have a really hard time of inviting them to change.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the word enabler, you know, I think we've all heard of that, but that's what you're speaking to also is people that do enable. Maybe they don't even know they're enabling some of these family members, but
yeah,
when you,
and,
yeah.
And I don't mean to interrupt you, but the word enable, yeah. the word codependent, they're overused, okay?
Yeah.
And so what I say is people do, families do the best that they can do with the resources they have. I give
mm-hmm.
everybody no-fault insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we're working together, we have a chance to change things.
Right.
And do things a little bit differently.
Right. So instead of even saying an enabler, again, this is more, I think, empowering if you say, like, now we're going to really teach that person how we want to be treated. You know, I think that there's something powerful when a family member does understand that they've been teaching the wrong way, and then now they have the choice to really have the boundaries, set them, speak their truth, and teach that person how they want to be treated and what they're not going to accept any longer.
You're absolutely correct. So I'm not going to accept you swearing at me anymore. I'm not going to accept you not coming home anymore. I'm not
right.
going to accept you lying. And most of all, I'm not going to accept, because oftentimes with families we deal with, they don't remember that they have money missing. Or
yeah.
that they gave a charge card. And so we teach families, like, hey, you know what? You're going to know where your money went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's just so many people out there that are really, you know, that are struggling with loved ones that are chronic relapsers. And, you know, I see the devastation when I meet with some of these family members, and it's intellectually, emotionally, spiritually just baffling to them how, for whatever reason, their loved one gets help, they get better for a little while, then they relapse, and so on and so forth. So how can we give people hope today in encouraging them that, you know what, sometimes it does take 10 times, sometimes it does take 15 times, sometimes it takes once. You know, it's a different journey for everybody. And I try to tell families that too, that just because this is the fourth time doesn't mean it could be the last, and to have some faith in that. But
you know, you're absolutely correct. A lot of times, sometimes I work with, I just did a lecture on failure to launch from 17 to 77. And what I really, when you talk about someone who is a chronic relapser, I think you're going to find within them a couple things. One, that they've really never had to take care of themselves, whether they're 53 or they're 18. That someone has made sure that they have food, clothing, and shelter to the extent. Now, that doesn't mean that they haven't gone to school. It doesn't mean that sometime or other they may have worked. They may not have ever had to work, but there's always been some sort of bailout. And the other thing is that maybe they grew up in those families that I talked about that were very fractured, very wounded. Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple things that we know that substance abuse disorders are a disease. Anybody that doubts that needs to go to March 2011, the American Society of Addiction Medicine definition. We also know as a disease entity, it can be chronic, progressive, and that relapse can be part of that disease. But we also know that it's multifaceted. And in families and in individuals that experience substance abuse disorders, they're wounded in many different ways. And it may be that they've never had two opportunities. One, a level of sobriety to begin to experience and learn life skills.
Yep.
And number two, depending on the level, an opportunity to work through grief and loss, whatever those incidents were that they experienced.
Right.
And had a village around them. And there are some great facilities in the United States that are specifically designed to work. Again, not all treatment centers are alike.
Right,
specifically
absolutely.
Designed to work with people who have had challenges in and chronic relapse. And in today's day and age, so many people are what we call dually diagnosed, or even what I wrote about, triple threat. And so, you know, that's sort of part of the issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know, you know, some people come to me, which they have in the past have had multiple experiences with the treatment center and outpatient center, but they never really got that individualized therapy that I feel is really important. Some of these treatment centers primarily provide group therapy and not so much individualized therapy. And so they're not addressing these core issues, these core injuries. And all of a sudden, when we could finally get to them, even as uncomfortable as it may be, you start to see a healing, you start to see a reframing, you start to see a light bulb go off. And there's really nothing more powerful than that, because it's all about changing your mindset. It's all about changing the internal dialogue.
You know what? You said that so beautifully, Erica. You're absolutely correct. And in early recovery, like, for example, you know, if we look at the trajectory, if someone is both dually diagnosed, let's just say, but in the beginning, what they have to experience is probably a medical detox, being free of substances. Then at this next next idea is, what other types of medication, if any, do they need? And when you think about early recovery, it's pretty black and white. You're going to learn tools to stay sober or abstinent, you know, to the extent that that is what you need to do. Right. After you have that kind of stability, then you're able to take a look at, as they say, the onion pulls itself off, and you can work on those wounds. And the question is, does anybody ever get to that point so you can work on the wounds? One of the really interesting things now, we have all treatment centers saying they're dually diagnosed, but in order to work on, you know, or do trauma-informed therapy, one has to have a certain amount of stability, because once you start opening up some of the things that happen to people, you have to be able to put them back together. And I mean, someone who's been a clinician for a long time, you have to know when that is.
I'm so happy that you said that. That is so right on. And people don't realize that that they do need that kind of support. Like you said, they do need that village. They do need people they trust. They do need to have some kind of rapport. And it is a special experience when you do create those relationships. It's just a matter of leaning in and kind of letting go or opening up to that. And like you said, these are all steps. This is a process. Things don't happen overnight. And again, you know, with saying that, I feel like a lot of people, you know, are impatient with this process. And a lot of family members I've seen through the years, you know, they want the instant results. And they're kind of at times say, you know, I'm just fed up with this. I can't deal with this. Can you fix my child, or can you fix my husband, or can you fix somebody? And they don't understand that this is a process that we all have to be committed to and build that muscle of patience and that muscle of understanding.
I love what you're saying, Erica, because like if you take a look at it, if I think about the majority of people that call us for help mm-hmm. or actually are calling treatment centers, if you look at age of onset of use, which may be 11, 13, unless we're talking about seniors who have late onset substance abuse disorder, we're talking about people that at least for one third of their life, to one half of their life, this is statistically correct, have been using mind-altering substances. Mm-hmm. So the idea that one can do the quick fix, make everything all better in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days is erroneous. What you can do is begin to lay a foundation on how to live a new life. Or what you can do is begin to live a foundation, even to teach someone how to write a check. Because a lot of people don't even know how to take care of their own finances because they've been, or even make their own food. I mean, make their own lunch. I've seen 37-year-old men who haven't, whose mothers are still making their lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so you have to think of the trajectory and think about what is it that we can do. And when you're talking about someone, you know, I always think, and I'm not saying inpatient treatment, but I always look at a family and try and say, okay, what is this going to look like a year from now? What kind of actually robust treatment is the family going to need for this loved one? Or sometimes because we're in California, the business manager, you know, or the estate attorney, what are they talking about for the people that they work for? And what do we look about if we're in a big picture? What does treatment look like?
Yeah, no, and I love that you say that because I feel like once you could visualize that or have some intention set with what does treatment look like, then we can work backwards in a sense and create like these small goals, like you said. I mean, I was just talking to a mother of a client yesterday, and I was just saying self-care. We're at the very beginning stages with her daughter, and it's self-care first. She doesn't know how to sleep. She doesn't know how to eat adequately. Nutrition has no idea about nutrition, has no idea about how to physically take care of herself, hasn't, you know, really developed a routine or created those, you know, created a lifestyle where she even makes her bed. So these are, you know, everybody's different, but we have to address the individual based on where they're at in life. And I feel like it's so wonderful that you do that in such a, you know, really an awe-inspiring way, because the attention to detail is what really helps these families get through. It's really what helps people to have a sustainable recovery. So I really appreciate everything you've shared with us today. Can you tell us, Dr. Louise, where people could find you?
Yes, you can find me through my website, which is www.allaboutinterventions.com, or you can pick up the phone and dial 619-507-1699, and you don't get an answering service. You get me, as long as I'm not engaged with someone else.
That's fantastic. Thank you for being so available to everyone out there. And Dr. Louise has a book called Falling Up, a Memoir of Renewal, which we'll be talking about soon. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you for joining us, and stay well.